chapter 23, verse 17. Verse reads, "There shall be no whore of the daughters of Israel, nor a sodomite of the sons of Israel. You shall not bring the hire of a whore or the price of a dog into the house of the Lord your God for any vow, for even both these are abomination unto the Lord your God." To understand these particular verses, you need to know that among the Canaanite cults, the practice of male and female prostitution was rampant. The gods of the Canaanites were mostly related to the fertility of either the people or the land. So to appease them or to urge them into action on part of the worshiper, ritual sexual acts were performed at their worship sites. Israel was not to be so, and neither are Christians. Verse 18 is an emphasis of the statement found in verse 17. The money that would be earned by a harlot or a dog, and that is a euphemism for a sodomite, was never to be brought into the house of God for any reason, especially to pay a vow. If we have promised to give or do anything for God on a vow, while God expects us to fulfill that vow, it can never be paid by doing an unrighteous act to complete it. Everything that is related to our God must be holy. In verse 19, we read, "You shall not lend upon usury to your brother, usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. Unto a stranger you may lend upon usury, but unto your brother you shall not lend upon usury, that the Lord your God may bless you in all that you set your hand to in the land where you go to possess it." An Israelite was forbidden to charge interest to a fellow Israelite for a loan. Now, we used the word loan previously, in which we described it as really charity toward a person. These loans were always for the purpose of helping someone who was having a hard time. How could the person who needed help ever get back on his feet if he was always pushed farther down by the added interest? Very practical about today's economy, I would think. The term stranger here is a temporary foreign visitor, such as a caravan merchant. The type of lending to the stranger here would be a business loan, which is similar to an investment that you would expect to make an increase. This had to be a business loan because in Leviticus 25, verses 35 and 36, even strangers were to be relieved if they were in need with no interest charged. We read there, "And if thy brother be waxen poor and fall in decay with thee, then thou shalt relieve him. Yea, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with thee. Take thou no usury of him or increase, but fear thy God that thy brother may live with thee. Thou shalt not give him thy money upon usury, nor lend him thy victuals for increase." In verse 21 in chapter 23 of Deuteronomy, "When you shall vow a vow unto the Lord your God, you shall not slack to pay it, for the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and it would be sin in you. But if you shall forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in you. That which is gone out of your lips, you shall keep and perform, even a freewill offering, according as you have vowed unto the Lord your God, which you have promised with your mouth. You may make a vow to God if you desire, but you do not have to make one if you do not want to. This is an essence in all vows, because when you make a vow to someone else, it was to be made in the name of Jehovah. The Lord does not demand that you make vows to Him, but only that if you do, you do not fail to keep that vow in a timely fashion, because faithfulness is part of His character. Likewise, never allow someone to force or coerce you into making a vow. Be very aware, for these coercions can catch you unawares, especially those that ask you to vow something that on the surface appears to be good and right. Always consider the far-reaching ramifications of what you are promising to do before you put your name on the line. You are not permitted to make a vow that violates God's law, for then that would be sin. One of the times that you need to be very careful, and it happens quite a bit, especially in churches, where perhaps a special offering or something is taken up for a group, and an effort has been really put into the pleading for it. And yet, if you do not desire to do that, all right, be very careful there, because they may have wooed you by your heart, and yet you haven't conscientiously listened and thought it out carefully with your mind. Once you've made a commitment, you're responsible to God for its completion. If we will be held accountable for every idle word that comes out of our lips, how much more will we be held accountable for purposed words that come out of our lips? As a father, I tried not to make promises to my children that I knew or was not sure that I could keep. In verses 24 and 25, when you come into your neighbor's vineyard, then you may eat grapes your fill at your own pleasure, but you shall not put any in your vessel. When you come into the standing corn of your neighbor, then you may pluck the ears with your hand, but you shall not move a sickle into your neighbor's standing corn. The life principle that's recorded here is don't overuse another's kindness. A traveler in Israel could stop in a vineyard or a field and eat of the fruit that was ready to eat so as to quench his hunger. But he could not take anything with him when he continued on his way. The small portion that the traveler would take would not be missed by the landowner, and he could expect the same privilege whenever he had to travel. If you do overuse another's kindness, you are guilty of stealing. Also, take care not to injure your neighbor's property during his activity. For instance, when you're walking through your neighbor's garden, don't take his first ripe tomato that he's been diligently looking for or to eating. Chapter 24, verse 1. When a man has taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes, because he has found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement, and give it in her hand, and send her out of his house. And when she is departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. And if the latter husband hates her and writes her a bill of divorcement and gives it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband die, which took her to be his wife, her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife. After that she is defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not cause the land to sin, which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance. In ancient Israel, there developed two schools of thinking, the Shammai and the Hillel. The majority of teachers followed Hillel. These verses illustrate their differences in interpretation. The Shammai believed that some uncleanness in her was limited to infidelity. The Hillel believed that this phrase had a wider latitude and allowed divorce for many different reasons. Jesus was asked this question, and he firmly took the position of the Shammai. In Matthew 19, it says, "The Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him, and saying unto him, Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And he answered and said unto them, Have ye not read that which he made them at the beginning, made them male and female? And said, For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one. Therefore, there are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder." They said unto him, "Why did Moses then command to give a writing a divorcement and to put her away?" He said unto them, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, suffered you to put away your wives. But from the beginning it was not so. And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, commits adultery, and whoso marries her whom is put away, doth commit adultery. A man and woman caught in the act of adultery, according to the law, were to be stoned. However, adultery can take place in secret, and yet evidence eventually shows itself. Divorce was permitted in this case. Joseph is an example of this. In Matthew 1, it says, "Now the birth of Jesus Christ was on this wise, when as his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph before they came together, she was found with child of the Holy Ghost. Then Joseph, her husband, being a just man, and not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away in private." The restriction on divorce that's given here is if a man divorces a woman and she then remarries and the second husband either divorces her or he dies, the first man cannot come and marry her. The same would be true if the roles were reversed. This is an abomination before God because it makes a mockery of marriage, which was instituted by God. This is a reason for seeking reconciliation in the original marriage, for reconciliation reflects the character of God and His actions toward fallen mankind. In verse 5, "When a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war, neither shall he be charged with any business, but he shall be free at home 1 year, and shall cheer up his wife, which he has taken." God wants strong families. His law does all that it can to ensure that family life is strong from the very start. When a man got married, he was not permitted for one full year to go join the army in battle to ensure he was not killed. He was also free for one full year from any public service that would in any way take him away from home. During that year, he was to bind with his wife and establish his home and hopefully produce a child to carry on the family name. Remember that there were no quick marriages at this time. The newlyweds had known each other for some time during their engagement, so when the wedding day came, they were ready to be about the business of becoming one and establishing their family. Verse 6, no man shall take the bottom or the upper millstone to pledge, for he takes a man's life to pledge. When a loan is given, the promise to repay is usually accompanied by collateral. The lender is forbidden to take either one of the millstones from a grist mill as his collateral. The reason is that the mill becomes useless when one of the stones is taken and the owner cannot use it to make a living. The principle taught is that those who lend should never deprive the person to whom they lend the ability to make a living and eventually to repay the loan. One of the worst examples of this in our country was the loans given to farmers, and eventually the calling of the loans forcing the foreclosure of the land, because now the farmer has lost his ability to make any kind of a living. In verse 7, if a man be found stealing any of his brethren of the children of Israel, and makes merchandise of him, or sells him, then that thief shall die, and you shall put evil away from among you. While this law deals with what we call today kidnapping, its main thrust is the slave trade. The scriptures permitted forms of slavery, but regulated it strictly to provide protection to the slave. For no reason was the Israelite to traffic in slaves. If he was caught selling a person, especially another Israelite, and selling him as a slave, he was to be put to death. My God wants us to have a reverence for every human. There's still a slave trade going on in the world today. We need to be aware of it and to do our best to stop its inhumanity. In verse 8 and 9, take heed in the plague of leprosy that you observe diligently and do according to all that the priest, the Levite, shall teach you. As I commanded them, so you shall observe to do. Remember what the Lord your God did unto Miriam by the way, after that you were come forth out of Egypt. Whenever you read in the scriptures about leprosy, you must keep in mind that in 99.9% of the cases, it's not speaking of Hansen's disease, or what we call as modern day leprosy. Leprosy is a general term for any infectious disease that shows its signs on the skin. Chickenpox, measles, mumps, okay? All those would have something on the skin that would indicate that you had the infectious disease. To protect the majority of the people, the infected person was to be quarantined outside the camp. The priests and Levites were taught to recognize these signs and were given the authority to put someone in quarantine or to release them from it You can find these directions in Leviticus 13 and 14. These laws were to be enforced strictly. The spread of a disease was a dreaded event. There was to be no waffling because of the position held by the infected person. Even a leader such as Miriam was forced to stay outside of the camp. There are many moral lessons that this law pictures. If sin is allowed to remain in close proximity, it will spread. We need to remove it. A physical lesson for today also is that we have become complacent about infectious disease. We believe that with all the medications that we have today, that anything can be cured. That is so far from the truth that it is ludicrous that we even think that way. The super germ is always there, just waiting for the right person. Because of that, we have twisted the law to give everyone their right of access to everyone else, to the point that people carrying life-threatening diseases are all around us without us knowing who they are. Such as the child I had in my classroom with hepatitis C, and I was the only one that was allowed to know about it. Christians should not be this way. We should have such care for others, especially our brothers, that we willingly will keep ourselves away from others when we know we are infectious. We are not to be germophobic, but always to show due diligence. When you lend your brother anything, in verse 10, you shall not go into his house to fetch his pledge. You shall stand abroad, and the man to whom you do lend shall bring out the pledge abroad unto you. And if the man be poor, you shall not sleep with his pledge. In any case, you shall deliver him the pledge again when the sun goes down, that he may sleep in his own raiment and bless you, and it shall be righteousness unto you before the Lord your God. It is common to hold some collateral for a loan. This law protected the borrower by keeping the lender from entering his house uninvited. If he was left unchecked, the lender could take something that was worth more than the agreed upon pledge. This also protected the dignity of the borrower. This law is one of the bases for our present law against the unreasonable search and seizure. The most valuable thing a poor man might own was his outer coat. If he gave this for a pledge, the lender had to return it to him each night so that he would have a cover during the cold night. If he returned the coat, it was a righteous act observed by God. The nuisance of returning the coat every day would probably cause one to forget even taking the pledge in the first place. This law is probably illustrated in the lost axe head in 2 Kings 6. You shall not oppress a hired servant that is poor and needy, whether he be of your brethren or of your strangers that are in your land within your gates. At his day you shall give him his hire, neither shall the sun go down upon it, for he is poor and sets his heart upon it, lest he cry against you unto the Lord, and it be sin unto you. People at this time would hire workers by the day. Anyone who would work this way was poor and in need of the money, in most cases just to buy food for that day. That is why this law was so important. The promised pay must be given each evening when the work was done. Times and practices are different today, but the principle for the employer is still active that pay for work done must be timely and sure. Nothing is said here about the amount of pay. It is assumed that the worker would receive the standard daily wage for his work. And Jesus uses this law in his parable about the workers hired at different times of the day. God deals with every person, and the last verse that we'll look at is verse 16. The fathers shall not be put to death for the children, neither shall the children be put to death for the fathers. Every man shall be put to death for his own sin. God deals with every person as an individual. You will not be punished for my sins, and I will not be punished for yours, although the evil each of us does may affect the other. Each of us may stand in the judgment, must stand in the judgment, and give an account of what we do in our bodies. As it is with God, so it should be among men. When a father or a child breaks a law, only the guilty party should pay the penalty. This was a common practice, though, in heathen times, that an entire family would be wiped out for a particular breaking of the law, especially in the idea of rebellion. God illustrates this when he punishes Korah for his rebellion during the Exodus. The earth opened and swallowed Korah and those who remained in his tent. But the children of Korah lived and continually served God in the tabernacle. In the problem with Achan and Joshua, it is true that Achan's children were also killed. But here it must be rightly assumed that everyone in the tent were complacent in the crime that was committed. If someone is guilty of offending you, and you cannot peacefully settle the matter, do not hold this offense against other members of that offending person's family. And that's it.